The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
When you turn on the evening news, do you see what you want to see or what you need to see? Welcome to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. It seems like more often than not, the good news and people that are making it are buried into a two-minute feature piece near the end of the report. What about giving these people and this kind of news a full hour every week? Now, here's your host, Mariana Cacciatore.
Good morning and welcome to Bread for the Journey Radio. We've got a great show for you today. We'll be interviewing Frank Ostiseski. He's the founder of the groundbreaking hospice called Zen Hospice and his current project, Meta Institute, a national education program on mindful and compassionate end-of-life care. But before we begin our show, I'd like to say a few words about Bread for the Journey, a nonprofit organization. I'm its executive director, and our work in the world is to find people who are passionate about improving their community and help them make it happen. We make it easy to make a difference in your community. So the way this works is people all around the country have formed chapters of Bread for the Journey. We have 20 of them in cities everywhere. I give them nonprofit status and allow them to pool a few dollars from friends, family, colleagues, and give it away to people in the community who are doing things to make the place they live a little more vibrant, vital, healthy, just. And we give to a wide range of things: children, youth, elders, environment, education, art, social services, you name it. We give micro grants, small amounts of money with no strings attached, no grant proposals. Instead, what we do is we meet with people over a cup of tea or a meal, and we learn about their program that way. And if the fit is right, we give them a grant to help advance their work. So last year, our strategic planning sessions, we got very clear that we wanted more visibility. We've been around since 1988, nearly 25 years, and we want now, and we're a little quiet, we always have operated a bit under the radar, but we want people to know that they can come to us if they want to make a difference in their community, and we want to help them make that happen. So that's how Bread for the Journey Radio was born. We thought, you know, it might be nice to introduce you to the kinds of people we get to know by doing this work. We've been really blessed, and we've met some incredible people all around the country. So with the radio show, I've had the opportunity to interview them, and we've been doing that for the past several months, and we've gathered all those interviews in archives. So if you'd like to listen to any of our previous shows, you can go to breadforthejourney.org, and on the home page in the lower right corner, look for my photo and click on the word tune in, and the entire show series is there. You can listen right away, or you can download it as a podcast and listen later. Or you can go to voiceamerica.com's website, and our show is in the Variety section, and you can access all the archived shows from there as well. And if you'd like to be on our mailing list so that you get notices of the shows that are happening each week, we send out one little notice on Friday mornings of the show that's going to air the following day. You can contact us at breadjourney@gmail.com and just give us your email address. We'll put you on our list and we'll send you notices of the show. So our guest today, Frank Ostiseski, is just the kind of person a Bread for the Journey chapter would give a grant to. He's a Buddhist teacher, a healthcare consultant, and founder of two incredible programs, Zen Hospice and Metta Institute. His groundbreaking work on the contemplative care of the dying has been featured on the Oprah Winfrey Show, on Bill Moyer's documentary on end-of-life care that was called On Our Own Terms, and lots of other the Metta Institute and Zen Hospice. His work has been featured in lots of other media outlets as well. So Frank's current project, the Metta Institute, is a stunning program that provides broad-based education on mindful and compassionate end-of-life care. I know several teachers from his program, and I can tell you they're good people and stellar educators, in addition to Frank himself, Charles Garfield, Rachel Remen, Frances Vaughn, Angelus Arian, a very impressive group, which I think speaks to the reputation that Frank has earned over the years. So welcome, Frank. It's a delight to have you on the show today.
Oh, I'm really happy to be with you this morning.
Thanks. You know, the words mindful and compassionate stand out for me as I describe your lifelong body of work in end-of-life care. And before we dive in, I guess I want to begin by thanking you on behalf of all who have been touched by your work, directly or indirectly. Your vision and your heart have, I believe, changed countless end-of-life experiences from something clinical and unfeeling to an event that is warm, tender, honest, and real. So thank you so much, Frank.
Oh, you're very welcome, of course. And you know, I always feel like I need to give credit back to the people who allowed me to sit at their bedsides as they were dying, to share with them this extraordinarily vulnerable moment of their lives. I really think of them as my teachers, you know, and I always want to give my teachers all the credit for anything I've learned.
And you were a good student. I know in the work that I've done in grief that what I had to work through when I was first in the presence of somebody, and in my case, it wasn't who was dying, but it was somebody who was grieving the death of someone else, is that I had to do my work to be able to really be present. And I imagine that was true for you, that as you were developing this sort of body of knowledge, you took yourself along on a journey that began not where you are today, but in a place of learning. Not that you're not learning today, but you understand.
Yeah. No, I think what you're saying is true. If we're going to really be a trustworthy presence for someone else who's experiencing the challenges of life, and particularly the challenges of dying or grieving, we have to do our homework. This is intimate work, and we can't do it from a distance. So it means we have to be part of the equation. So that means if I'm going to be with someone else's suffering, I have to really have explored my own. Otherwise, the patient that I'm working with will understand that when I say I understand, they'll know that I'm just guessing, and they'll sniff out my sentimentality and my insincerity. So yes, we have to do our own homework. We have to turn toward our own suffering, sit down with it, have a cup of tea, get to know it really well.
Yeah, yeah. And it isn't always easy work. I know when we were doing trainings, there's the information that we pass on. That's one piece of it. And then there's the experience of how it's being received at the other end by the person who's in the training. And we had to be fully present with the full emotional gamut. And I imagine that happens. Well, let's talk for a minute about Metta Institute and a little bit about those trainings, because I imagine that's what occurs there, and I'd like to give our listeners a context for how we might talk about this.
Okay. Well, the Metta Institute, first of all, is an outgrowth of my work at the Zen Hospice Project, where for 20 years I spent time at the bedsides of people who were facing the final moments of their lives. And when you sit there at the precipice of death, you learn things. You learn what's really important. And I felt a certain responsibility to those people for the lessons they offered me I felt a responsibility to share those lessons with others. So we created the Metta Institute as basically an educational organization to specifically work with caregivers, both professional clinicians and family caregivers, around how to support someone going through the dying process, how to provide the psychological and spiritual support that people need in addition to good medical care. So we formed a faculty, an organization. You mentioned some of them in your introduction. Old friends, Ram Dass, Rachel Naomi Remen, the author of Kitchen Table Wisdom, Charlie Garfield, who started the first peer-to-peer AIDS program in the nation, the Shanti Project. A wonderful faculty of people. And our idea was to create a kind of legacy, to share what others had helped us to understand with a wider audience of people. So we run a program called the End of Life Care Practitioner Program. And it's a 2-year project that offers 5 5-day retreats. People can come to one of those, or they can come to the series of them. We like to suggest, of course, that they come to the series because it's more comprehensive. And people can find out information about that program at our website, MettaInstitute.org. That's M-E-T-T-A-Institute.org. What we're trying to do there is support a kind of gentle revolution. Mm-hmm. You know, dying is much more than a medical event. And we have to stop treating it as if that's all it was. For me, it's much more an issue of relationships. It's our relationship with ourselves, with those we love, with God, or however we might name the ultimate kindness in the universe. And so then caring for the dying or accompanying the dying is a matter of supporting and facilitating those relationships.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, at its heart, what we're trying to do at the Metta Institute, is help people to really recognize that and also become skillful at how to cultivate and develop those relationships.
Mm-hmm. You know, you said, dying is more than a medical event, and it makes me think about, you know, how we've handled it in the past and how we're handling it today. And I'm curious to know, for the people who are working in hospital settings where, and they, even if it might be a hospice within a hospital setting, what's the landscape generally like today in terms of creating the kind of environment one needs to be able to have it not be so much a medical event, but a personal event? Can you share a little bit about what you're hearing?
Yeah, I tend to be an optimist, so I'm going to speak to that side of the equation, but it would be useful to also recognize that it's a both-and. We know, all of us, anybody who's had any encounter with the healthcare system these days, that it's in trouble, that there are greater demands on the clinicians, budget cuts, staff turnover, huge issues. And, of course, that impacts the way in which people are cared for at the end of their lives. Having said that, I also believe or also see that the effect of all our work over the last 20 or 30 years is beginning to be felt. Mm-hmm. People are coming into the experience of dying with more clarity. They know more about what they want. Their families are often engaged and supporting them. And this might not have been the case just 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and I think there's a greater consciousness, awareness around the fact that dying is a whole person event. It's not simply a matter of addressing symptoms or managing pain. Mm-hmm. So I think things have improved in that regard, and I still think we have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So walk us a little bit through, let's just say, the first session of your 5-session series. Who are the kind of people that are coming, and what might they expect when they get there? And we've talked a moment ago about it's one part of this is communicating information, another part is dealing with the feelings that arise when we're doing this work. So with all of that in mind, can you speak a little bit about what one of your training sessions might be like? Let's call it the opening one.
Okay. So first of all, let's just for some context here. So think of five trainings over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And what we tried to do was select themes that were most needed addressing by healthcare professionals. And so the themes were, first is really service, mindful and compassionate service. The second is wise relationship. How do we develop skillful relationships with the clients we serve? The third was, how do we collaborate? This is really to address the problems within the healthcare setting. How do we work with others toward a common goal? And the fourth is really opening to mystery, the mystery that characterizes the dying process. And the fifth is really about the cultivation of presence or mindfulness, the tool or skill that we think is most needed in around the time of dying. So that's the overview of the five. Let me come back to the first one. First is titled Mindful and Compassionate Service. And this is, for us, this is a really important territory, this territory of service. Service is different than helping or fixing. Service is really characterized by addressing the whole person, recognizing the whole person, both as the caregiver and also as the patient in this case. And in this exchange, this mutually beneficial exchange of service, both people are served.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really different perspective than I'm the good guy on the white horse and you're the poor unfortunate one and I'll help you out. Yeah.
Right.
So as it relates to healthcare workers, you know, professionals are facing these unbelievable institutional constraints and urgency to work harder and faster and reduction in critical resources, and these stressors contribute to a certain kind of self-neglect within the lives of the clinicians. And that leads to a kind of distancing from patients and a disconnection from those patients and from the professionals' motivating intention to serve. And so what this particular five-day training about is about reinvigorating that calling, re-exploring what got me to do this work in the first place. I didn't do it just for a paycheck. I came into this work because it has meaning and value for me. You know, one of the questions that we often ask our professionals is, what's the first thing you remember caring for in your life? Was it your doll, a pet, a younger brother or sister? And then we ask them, how old were you when this first happened? And inevitably, what we find when we poll people about this is that action started around age 5.
Mm.
So what we're suggesting here is that this calling for most healthcare professionals started a long, long time ago, you know, and their choice is really an outcome of that calling.
Right. I'm going to interrupt you for a moment, and I really want to stay on this subject of how deeply each one of us felt that calling and how long it's been with us. But we have to take a break, and to our listening audience, please stay with us. We'll be back in just a few minutes, and we're talking to Frank Ostaseski of the Meta Institute. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Find out about new shows, featured guests, and what's up this week. Find us on Facebook by searching keyword Voice America.
Are you an entrepreneur that wants to achieve more? Not just in it for profit, but to do work you find meaningful, that adds more value to more people in more ways? Listen for Be More, Achieve More, Inspiration for the Entrepreneurial Mind with host Chris Cooper. You'll hear from successful achievers from around the world with the passion and experience to offer invaluable guidance. These people are making a difference and will help give you the motivation and insight to achieve more. Be More, Achieve More can be heard live Fridays at 8 a.m. U.S. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Is your computer making your life easier or more of a headache? Are you using all of the tools to make your life more productive and less of a stress? You need to listen to the Microsoft Princess Insider with Melanie Goss, dubbed the Microsoft Princess. Melanie has been a certified expert in all things Microsoft since 1998, and her expertise will have you taking back control of your life and letting your computer handle the efficiency of day-to-day projects. The Microsoft Princess Insider airs live every Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and we're here talking to Frank Ostaseski of the Meta Institute, a impressive program that provides broad-based education on mindful and compassionate end-of-life care. And we've been talking about the teachings that come from the Meta Institute for people who are working in end-of-life care, whether they're clinical people or the family and loved ones of somebody who are volunteers or working with somebody who might be dying. And in the first session of this training, we're talking about the topic, mindful and compassionate service, and how the relationship between the person who's dying and the person who is being with them is mutually beneficial, and that we all sort of are in the room doing our work. And just recently spoke a bit about going back in time for that person who's in the training to a time when they first cared for somebody. And Frank was saying that often what they find is that the people are somewhere around 5 years old, the earliest memory they have of being in that relationship of wanting to care for something, they can recall to a time when they were about 5 years old. And so this calling is old and deep. By the time they come into these trainings, they're in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and they've been carrying this with them their entire life. So that's where we were. Let's continue on, Frank.
Beautiful. Well, for service, true service to happen, it seems that there's a couple of characteristics that we want to explore together. Mm-hmm. One of those is simply self-awareness, really to really learn to see through the mind's conditioning and our habitual responses and to recognize the obstacles that are there for our manifesting or living out our deepest intention and service. So self-awareness mm-hmm. is important.
So I just want to say this again. You said the obstacles that stand in the way. Is that what I heard you say? That your voice popped out for a moment. Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah. So let's touch on those for a minute, actually. Mm-hmm. So what are the obstacles that really get in our way? You know, what I found in being a companion to the dying, I needed two or three things. The first of those is I had to really be willing to be compassionately present for suffering. In other words, I had to really be willing to stay in the room when the going gets rough, you know, not to run out, to give no fear, we say. Mm-hmm. The second was that I had to be willing to release myself and others from what I would call the limitations of roles. You know, when I'm dying, I don't want a role next to me. I don't want a dinner roll, and I don't want, you know, someone pretending to be a role. Right. I want a human being. I want somebody real. Yeah. So sometimes when we're just acting out a role, we tend to imprison ourselves and those we serve. Right. And the third is more difficult to articulate, but it's something like having a deep and abiding trust in the process of dying itself, to really recognize that dying has about it certain conditions that are actually conducive and supportive to our growth and transformation. Mm-hmm. So those are qualities that I would need to develop as a companion to someone at the end of life. So when mm-hmm. we look at our program on service, which we really work on the development of those characteristics. Mm-hmm. So self-awareness. Second would be compassion. You know, compassion, you know, is a word that we throw around a whole lot these days in the culture, and it's tended to become something like a Hallmark card. I don't think of it that way. I think of compassion as a kind of deep attunement, an intimacy, really, with ourselves and others. It's that part of us that rises up as guidance to respond to the presence of suffering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing we need to do is be skillful. You know, so we can be mindful and self-aware, and we can be compassionate, but then we have to be skillful. We have to make sure that our behaviors are congruent with our intentions. Mm-hmm. And so we have to help people understand, well, this is how you have the conversation. This is mm-hmm. the way you enter the room. This is what gets in the way of authenticity. So self-awareness, compassion, and skillful action. Those are the mm-hmm. the primary focus of that first program, Mindful and Compassionate Service.
Mm-hmm. I'm often, I know for me in working with people in this tender place that most of my lessons actually happened in the field. There were, I was trained, and then suddenly there I was in the middle of the process itself. And I couldn't even see the times when I was playing a role. Until I was actually in it. Had you spoken to me about that, I might not have so much identified with it. But then the minute I was in the experience, I could, if I was aware and awake, or even, I don't know, a few hours later, reflecting back on the experience, there were these aha moments where I could see that I was playing a role, or that my own fear of suffering got in the way of my ability to be there with their suffering.
And what helped you to get to bring that to your attention? What did you notice?
Well, I was I'm one of those people who, if I'm not in the moment, I oftentimes will reflect on it later and see it. If I can't do it in the moment, I'm a reflector. I don't know. So afterwards, I'd see it. Or if it happened in the moment, what I would notice is that my mind was racing with a set of thoughts of, I need to say just the right thing in this moment. That's what they want. I need to do just the right thing. That's what they want. Instead of being calm and being really present. And the thing that helped me the most to move away from that was my breath. I'd been meditating for years when I began this work, and using my breath to calm my heart. And I don't know, something bigger than me stepped in those moments. And suddenly I found myself slow breathing my way through the moment. And something would click, and I'd finally realize my mind wasn't busy any longer, and I was fully present, and the idea of needing to do anything perfect for that person fell away, and I was there and present.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, I sometimes talk about what I call helper's disease, you know, mm-hmm. and I think it's more rampant than cancer and AIDS and heart conditions, you know. And I'm talking about the ways that we try to set ourselves apart from others, other people's suffering, you know, through our roles, right. Our protocols, our professional warmth, you know. Even our charitable acts. You know, sometimes when we write a check, we do that. It's not always a way of coming close to the suffering. It's a way of distancing ourselves.
Right.
And as I said earlier, you know, if we're not careful, we're going to trap ourselves in that prison, and we're going to trap the people we serve.
Right. Even at Bread for the Journey, you know, you just touched on, you know, there's a way in which you can be very distant as you're even writing a check. And one of the things our founders, Wayne Muller, who you know, set up when he set up this beautiful model that we are replicating in cities around the country is that we don't even allow written grant proposals. What we want to do is meet people over a cup of tea, and we want to sit and listen to them tell the story of what they've experienced and how it is they know that what they've created is something that will help the community. And in that way, we are really fully present and more in touch rather than one step removed, reading a bunch of words on paper and then making a decision to write a check. Not that is a bad thing to do for organizations that do that. I don't mean to say that. But I think we have there's huge benefit from just meeting people in person and being fully present with them as they tell that story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that brings us back to this thing I was talking about how relationships, you know, when the nature of service is characterized by healthy, whole relationships, you know, then true service happens. A lot of times in this work, particularly in the healthcare community, and I really want to make sure that we don't give the impression that we're in any way speaking down about healthcare workers. I have tremendous empathy for physicians and nurses and other healthcare professionals. But, you know, hospitals and medical environments have a kind of fix-it mentality. Mm-hmm. And that's useful, of course. We're really grateful that they fix things. But sometimes what can happen when we have a protocol or a plan that'll move us through some anticipated process is that we miss actually what's happening right now.
Right. You know?
And relationship always happens right now. Right here in this moment, the immediacy of relationship.
So we've stepped into your second of the five classes, and which is titled Wise Relationship, correct?
Yeah. You know, let me share something with you that in your audience. Two, three years ago now, I was leading a training on compassionate care for a group of doctors and nurses when I suffered a very severe heart attack. And that was followed by emergency hospitalization, triple bypass surgery, and weeks, months of fragility and healing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, the view from the other side of the sheets is a really different vantage point. You know, I've been working with people in vulnerable situations for 30 years, but when I was the patient in the bed, one of the things that became clear to me was just how much physicians and nurses and others, good-hearted people, were closing down to their own pain. They were driven ruthlessly by unrealistic expectations of the system in which they worked, and so they began to employ these coping strategies that had them ignoring their own pain, and that was really difficult to see. As Jung said, inside every physician is a wounded person.
Mm.
And inside every patient, there is a physician capable of contributing to his or her healing. Yeah? I like that very much.
Mm-hmm.
That puts us both on an equal footing, doesn't it? When we see each other that way.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things I saw when I was in the hospital, for example, you know, people came in the room. They didn't really ask me how I felt. They asked me where my pain was on a scale of 1 to 10, or whether I'd had a bowel movement that day, or whether I was doing my breathing exercises. But they didn't really connect with me. To be honest, they had more of a relationship with the instruments they brought in the room than they did with me. They monitored me. And what part of what that was that it's part of their training, but it's also part of the system that they work in. The emphasis is on problem solving. And while that's necessary, and I wouldn't be sitting here talking with you if they didn't solve my problem, one of the things that can happen when we focus only on problem solving is that we intensify the patient's contraction. And pretty soon what happens is the patient, like me, loses contact with their own resourcefulness. And gradually what happens is the person disappears and only the problem remains.
Mm.
That's a real challenge for us. Now, there's an alternative to that. And the alternative is that as caregivers, we can be something other than problem solvers. We can be portals to a larger possibility. You know, if we're a nurse or a family caregiver, we move somebody from the bed to the commode and we lend them the strength of our back, of our shoulders, of our legs. We can also lend people the stability of our minds and the fearlessness of our hearts. And we can be a reminder of confidence. And we can open our hearts in such a way that maybe we inspire the individual who's struggling to open theirs. And then we become a true compassionate refuge. Then we're in a relationship that is soul to soul. Mm-hmm. Soul to soul. Yeah. So when I speak of wise relationship, that's what I'm speaking about. Yeah.
I understand. And I can see sort of a hospital of the future and why hospitals might want to, I don't know, sit with you and begin to develop a visionary eye toward what tomorrow's hospital might look like. And I can also see the incredible challenge ahead for hospitals that, you know, in addition to this sort of problem-solving mentality, to then have, as you call it, mindfulness and compassion as they enter the room. And the huge benefit of that is that if you can touch a patient in that way, you actually create the ground for them being a participant in their own healing rather than intensify their contraction, as you speak about. We've got to go to break again, and I'm having such a great time with you, and I hope our listeners are as well. And so please stay with us. We'll be back in just a few minutes and continue talking with Frank Ostiseski.
Stay connected. Sign up for our newsletter. Go beyond your favorite Voice America shows. Visit iradioblog.com.
Michelle Kors 6 Degrees is your connected consciousness. 6 Degrees is what comes around, goes around radio. Committed to delivering a fresh perspective on thought-provoking, investigative information that can change your life. 6 Degrees connects you to the social and emotional scene and is your trusted advisor from finance to romance, mainstream to metaphysical. It's a positive, upbeat look at life, love, and the pursuit of passion. Get connected Saturdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America Variety Channel.
The inner workings of the mind and body are a fascinating study into who we are, our motivations, creativity, wants, and fears. Is everyone capable of great atrocities as well as great accomplishments? What haunts or helps us pursue the things we desire? We all want to know why we do the things we do and what makes us unique, but even more, we want to know what to do next. For answers to these questions, tune in to The Mind of the Matter with Dr. Susan Hickman on the Voice America Variety Channel every Thursday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific. Join us every week as we help you master the mind of the matter.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com. You are tuned in to Bread for the Journey, ordinary people doing extraordinary deeds, with your host, Mariana Cacciatore. If you have a question or comment about the program, or have an idea for a person you would like featured on a future program, please send an email to bfjradio@gmail.com. That's bfjradio@gmail.com. And now, back to Bread for the Journey.
Welcome back, and we're here talking to Frank Ostaseski of the Metta Institute, M-E-T-T-A, an educational program that provides broad-based education on mindful and compassionate end-of-life care. And Frank, one of the sessions that intrigues me that is within your five-session series in this two-year training that you do at Metta is one called Opening to Mystery. Can you tell us a little bit about what this is, what it means, Opening to Mystery?
Beautiful, yeah. This is, of course, the more difficult or challenging program to speak about. But so let's build on what we were just saying about relationship. If this work is primarily about relationship, what characterizes that relationship? So for me, when I'm dying, I want a relationship in which there's some, with an individual who has some degree of mastery. I want them to be able to manage my pain and symptoms, etc. So I want mastery. But mastery won't be enough. There'll be a juncture at which medicine doesn't have anything else to offer me. So then I need somebody who's comfortable in the territory of meaning. Someone who can help me discover what the purpose and value of my life has been, and even what I'm learning from this dying experience. Somebody can help facilitate that learning. But then there's a juncture in the dying process where meaning actually falls away, and we enter into a new territory, and that's the territory of mystery. And this is the territory of unanswerable questions. And in it, our primary role as a caregiver or companion is to bear witness. Really to bear witness to that which we cannot measure and explain, but can experience directly.
Mm-hmm.
For me, dying is a sacred event. It's not always treated that way. And when I say dying is a sacred event, I'm not talking about religion here. And I'm not talking about some extra special, you know, transcendental sort of experience. The sacred is not, seeing the sacred is not about seeing new things. It's about seeing things in a new way. So here's an example. I'm walking through a hospice one day, and there's this older African-American man, big guy. And I stop at his bedside, and he's sweating, and he's breathing with great difficulty. He's clearly actively dying. And I sit down beside him, and I say, "You look like you're working really hard." Because he did. And he said, "Yeah." And then he pointed toward the sky, and he said, "I just got to get there." And I said, "Listen, if I promise to keep up, can I come with you?" And he said, "Yeah." And he grabbed my hand. And I said to him, "I can't see there into the distance. Can you see?" And he described for me a sloping hillside to a kind of plateau. And I said, "You want to go?" "Yeah." And so we went walking up this hillside. He was puffing, huffing, and sweating. When it became clear to me that we'd reached this plateau, I said, "Can you see there further into the distance? I didn't bring my glasses. I can't see there way into the distance. What do you see?" And he described for me a little one-room red schoolhouse. Three steps and a door. This is a man who'd been born in Mississippi. I said, "You want to go?" "Yeah." So we walked toward this place. Now, I could have said to him at this point, "You're disoriented times three. You're in the hospital. This is a result of the morphine and the brain metastasis." But none of that was true. What was true is we were walking to a little red schoolhouse.
Right.
There's the three steps. There's the door. I said, "You want to go in?" "Yeah." I said, "Can I go?" I always ask permission. He said, "No." I said, "Okay." I said, "Okay, you go. You go then." And a few minutes later, he died very peacefully. See the sacred is not about seeing new things. It's about seeing things in a new way. And I think that, you know, the sacred's not something separate or different than everything else, but rather hidden in all things. And dying is a stripping away process. It's an opportunity to uncover what's hidden. It reveals the truth that was always there. And I think as a companion to someone who's dying, part of our work is to bear witness and support the gradual removal of the obscurations and perceptions that have blocked our capacity to see what's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is a beautiful story, and thank you so much for sharing it. And I loved the framework that you gave it as well by saying, you know, if you're on the dying bed, what you want is mastery. You want someone who can manage your pain and take care of the things that need to be done, and then sort of meaning, or helping you understand sort of the meaning of your own life or by just being fully present with you, I imagine. And then lastly, the mystery. And so I'm thinking about the people who are, you know, I don't know, coming to you for this training, and the place of having the skill sets to be able to manage your pain, and then I guess the skill set again to know when the patient it's sort of the next step is appropriate, and then when the third step is appropriate, and I'm also wondering. Well, I am wondering, do these sort of happen interchangeably? Are they a bit woven? Like, you know, I imagine there are times when all three of them are operating at the same time in a sense, or what's needed by the patient at the same time, that they're not necessarily in consecutive order. Can you talk a little bit about what that's like?
Sure. And you know, and for the sake of discussion, I've laid them out in a linear fashion, but by no means are they linear. They are often happening simultaneously. The need is simultaneous. People need mastery all the way through the dying process. So what we have to do as caregivers, whether it's professionals or family members, is get comfortable in these three territories, you know, really learn to be adepts, if you will, in these three territories. You know, the challenge with the last one, mystery, is that we associate mystery with uncertainty, with believing, we believe that we're supposed to have more of a handle on it, particularly if we're a healthcare professional. Mystery is not the same as uncertainty, really. You know, one of my mentors was Kubler-Ross, and she was an amazing teacher, and she laid out those famous five stages, which people misunderstood and took as a linear model. Elizabeth never meant them that way. She meant that these things explode onto the surface of our awareness, and that's true of what I just laid out as well.
Right. And you just said, you know, mystery is not the same as uncertainty. And from my viewpoint, what I would say, you know, the way I would understand that is, you know, that uncertainty has a little bit of discomfort in it, like I don't know and I'm anxious or and I want to. And mystery is, to me, evokes sort of a sense of, I don't want to always say spiritual because not everybody resonates so much with that word, but there's an unknown that isn't so much feared, but there's a curiosity and an ease. Can you speak about that? Do I have it right? And
I think you're speaking about it beautifully. You know, a word that we might use to support our discussion is surrender. And while it, you know, for some people it has a difficult connotation, surrender is a deep state of intimacy. And it's infinitely deeper than what we normally think of as acceptance. Acceptance is a kind of choice that we make. In surrender, I'm not sure there really is any choice, actually, to be honest. It feels more to me like a kind of pull, like a gravitational pull or an undertow even, or some kind of thread, if you will. The experience of letting go or acceptance might be stages which come before surrender, but the experience of surrender is quite different. And all of us have had some experience of surrender. You know, when I inquire with healthcare professionals or family members about this, you know, the common one that comes up is giving birth. Women speak to this experience all the time, how they were doing the process, and then there was a surrendering to the process. And in the surrendering, there was an expansion. I think that's a really important dimension of the experience of surrender and mystery, is that rather than a contraction, we feel it as a certain kind of expansion. And I see this regularly with people in their dying process. I worked with a lot of folks who lived on the streets of San Francisco. These were not Buddhist practitioners or spiritual adepts. They were ordinary people. Mm-hmm. And I regularly saw in them an arising of trust and faith, wonder and awe. All of these contributed to a certain degree to their experience of surrender.
Well, you know, my experience with people who are in that situation, who are not, who are in that situation, who live perhaps in poverty or have, you know, maybe more difficult lives, is that they have a lot of experience in surrender. There are many times where that powerlessness is visited with to them at their table, and they have to again and again learn to surrender to what they've been given.
Beautiful.
And,
yeah,
I imagine at the end of life they have perhaps a little more experience with it than others who've had more privilege in their life.
You know, if we think of the dying process as a process of transformation, then surrender is a pivotal stage in that transformation. It's when the inessential gives rise to the sacred, really. And I think it's involuntary, at least from the standpoint of our ego's capacity to control it. But often what happens in such a moment is a patient or an individual might feel as though, they might feel a little scared right there, because there's a lot of chaos that comes in this moment. And they might feel tremendous fear, actually, until they recognize that that sense of something larger, which they have a fear of being engulfed by, is actually their own deep nature. It's actually their own, the most essential part of their being. Mm-hmm. And then all resistance relaxes. Mm-hmm. And what was once so terrifying becomes actually our ally.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beautiful teaching by Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Zen teacher, who says, you know, enlightenment for a wave is the moment the wave realizes that it's the water. And at that moment, all fear of death disappears.
Mm-hmm. We're getting close to our end, and I'm reminded of a conversation I had once with Sharon Salzberger. She told me about sitting at the bedside of somebody who's hospitalized, and what she chose to do was match her breath to this patient's breath. And and I thought of that as such a physical way of being fully present with someone. This person, it was somebody she'd known for a while and was also a fellow meditator. And I mean, so many things are coming to mind. You know, the ways in which we, as a potential person who's going to die, can prepare ourselves for that dying through the kinds of meditation practices that you teach and, you know, that are taught everywhere around the world now. And this piece of the caregiver sitting at the bedside and matching their breath with the patient's breath, and some kind of union happening that helps calm everybody down and brings us to a place where that surrender is more possible than it might have otherwise been. So I am so grateful for this conversation today. Thank you so much, Frank.
Oh, I'm really, really glad to share it with you and also with your listeners. If I can, I'd like to just add one thing.
Sure, yes, please.
When we come into contact with how precarious this life actually is, we come to appreciate how precious it is. Mm-hmm. Then we don't want to waste a moment. Then we want to jump into our life with both feet and tell the people we love that we love them. Mm-hmm. To imagine that we can do all of this at the end of our life is an absurd gamble. To imagine we will have the strength of body, the emotional stability, the clarity of mind at that juncture is an absurd gamble. And so I want to encourage us all to practice now, to look at these issues now, to have these conversations now. The habits of our life have a very strong momentum, and that momentum carries into the time of our dying. So we need to ask ourselves, what are the habits I really want to create in my life now that will support and prepare me in this time of dying?
Mm-hmm. That's a perfect way to close today's session. And if you, our listeners, want to learn a little more about the Meta Institute, it's metainstitute.org, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. And Bread for the Journey, you can go to breadforthejourney.org. Bread for the Journey is a nonprofit organization that could use your support, and I believe the Meta Institute as well. If you find a place in your heart to make a financial contribution, please go to ours or Meta Institute's website. I think if we all pitch in a little bit, we really can change the world. And I close today, as I do every show, with the following. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be free. See you next week.
We hope our program inspired you this week. Please join Mariana Cacciatore for another edition of Bread for the Journey next Saturday at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.